can be lonely out there looking at the big, dark sky. Are we alone in the universe? Do we even exist at all? This is Central Standard. I'm Jeremy Bernfeld. Today on the show, we're pondering life's biggest questions and taking a crack at humanity's stickiest issues. We're stargazing with the Astronomical Society of Kansas City. Then later, we'll have philosopher Dr. Susanna Reiner in studio, and we'll ask her, how do I know this is all even real? So get your intellectual waders on. We're going deep. First, let's turn our attention skyward. Astronomers, moon junkies, stargazers, Milky Way addicts, I'm talking to you. My guests today are Rick Henderson and Joe Wright. They're both members of the Astronomical Society of Kansas City. It's a club dedicated to amateur stargazing and the science of astronomy. And this hour, we're going to bring you into space. Rick Henderson, Joe Wright, thanks for coming on the show.
You're welcome.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
So, Rick, by day you're an electrical engineer, but by night you're a fairly serious amateur astronomer. You know, you've spent hundreds of hours looking up at the stars. Why? What draws you to astronomy?
Well, it's pretty much an extension of the natural universe. But believe it or not, the primary reason I got interested in it is it's just fascinating and it's beautiful. I grew up out in the country, so if you wanted to see the stars, you basically went out in your backyard. Then I moved to Kansas City, and it's like somebody turned all the stars out. And believe it or not, moving to the city actually kind of made that the desire to go stargazing more intense because you can't see them in town. So, and then things led on, and eventually I bought my own telescope, and then my wife's going, well, why do you go out in the middle of nowhere by yourself? There's got to be other people like you. And that's what led me to the Astronomical Society.
So, Joe, you're also a dedicated stargazer. And the thing that's interesting to me is the stars have been around for millennia. You know, why do you keep going out underneath the stars? Do things change from week to week? You know, what's new?
Well, yeah, there are things that do change week to week and stuff that won't change in our lifetime. When we look at Jupiter, its rotation is just slightly over 9.5 hours or so. And you can actually see a change, a rotational change of Jupiter, where you'll see the moons crossing around in front of Jupiter and circling it, where they'll cast their shadow back on Jupiter. Other things like the Orion Nebula and the constellation Orion, that's really not going to change to our view as a visual observer in our lifetime. But there are still things that happen out there. A couple of years ago, we saw the remains of an impact on Jupiter at the Warco Observatory. So you do see stuff that's rather new happening, just like the comet that's in the western sky above Kansas City. So things stick around for a long time in space, but there's some things that will happen without us knowing it, and sometimes we actually get a chance to see it.
So when you go out and you got your telescope under your arm, I mean, do you still get kind of a rush, or are you still interested in the mystery of what you're going to find, you know, that specific night?
Oh, yeah. We seem to never get tired of looking at objects that we look at on a regular basis. The moon, even with the regular pair of binoculars that most people have in their homes, the moon is a fascinating thing. It's close. You can look at it daytime. You don't have to be out in the middle of the night. You don't have to be out in dark skies to see the moon and the planets. So we do repetition because we like looking at the beauty of some of the objects. But you do get surprised sometimes when you're just panning around with the telescope and you come onto something that you haven't noticed before. Then you start getting out a star chart or a computer program, and, hey, what is this? Then you log it into your observing log, or you're working on an observing ward that is through the Astronomical League. So, yeah, there's things that we look at regularly, and then there's things that really excite us that come around once in a lifetime.
Rick, will you explain a little more about the Astronomical Society of Kansas City?
Well, the ASKC has been around since the 1930s. It's one of the longest-running astronomical clubs in the United States. Currently, we've got a membership of around 420 people. We currently do a lot of things around the city for educational outreach. Joe also manages the Warkochesky Observatory for UMKC on top of Royal Hall. And then we operate own and operate Powell Observatory down in Lewisburg, Kansas. One of the advantages of that is we have one of the largest telescopes in a five-state area that's available to the public. In fact, it's one of the few large aperture telescopes that is available to the public just to go in and look at, or look through, I should say. We're open, you know, May through October to the public every Saturday. And then we also are open by reservation throughout the year. Plus, we do dozens of school events, community events, Science City, the Kansas City Zoo, the Nelson. Pretty much anybody that asks us, yeah, we'll show up. And we're all volunteers. We just do this because we either love it or because we're crazy. Or sometimes both,
I'm sure. You know, I've seen photos. I haven't been down there myself, but to the Powell Observatory. I mean, that's serious. Can you give people an idea of the scale of the telescope that we're talking about? I mean, this is not something that's in the living room.
Well, you'd have to have a pretty big living room. it's roughly a 30-inch diameter mirror, which gathers about 11,900 times as much light as the naked eye. So basically what that means is you can see something 11,900 times fainter than you can with the naked eye. And a lot of people confuse aperture with magnification. For example, it's kind of like a mechanic with a tool set. You know, you use the right tool for the right job. The 30-inch telescope, its main advantage is we can see very faint, fuzzy things like nebulas, galaxies, and that sort of thing. It does provide excellent views of planets and such, but, you know, you go for a bigger telescope because you're trying to look at things that are fainter and usually farther away. You can look at things 50, 100 million light years away, which is pretty mind-boggling when you think about it.
Yeah, you're telling me. So, Joe, how did you first get into astronomy? What sparked your interest?
Well, I've always been interested in science and mechanical things. My dad was a mechanic for TWA, so I grew up in a garage. Then working on the Astronomy Merit Badge as a Boy Scout down H. Roy Bartle Scout Reservation. Growing up in the city, then going down to Bartle or on overnights each month, the sky is vastly different, like Rick was talking about, going from the country to the city. I did the opposite, you know, on these overnights, 9 or 10 days down at Bartle, where there's no light pollution to speak of. And, you know, when you can see the Milky Way away from the city, it's just magnificent. And that really got me into it. And that's actually brought me to the ASKC, was meeting another club member that was down there and became friends and joined the club when we came back to town.
So take us through with you on an evening or an early morning stargazing. You know, what's the process? What do you need to bring with you? How does it work?
Well, it depends on what you're going to be what your targets are going to be, what you want to do. I mean, if it's the moon, then you have a wide range of, do you want to use your binoculars or do you just want to use a telescope? And you don't have to go outside the city. You can do it in your backyard. But as Rick said, if you want to go for galaxies and faint objects, then you want to get away from the city light. So you're going to be packing your gear, your telescope, make sure you have some form of electricity if you need it, batteries, generators, or, you know, if you go down to one of our locations and you got, you know, club members have AC power, and your telescope equipment. And the main thing is, the two important things, the dress for the weather, take extra, just in case, because it can get cold at night, as everybody around here knows, and take snacks. Keep yourself energized. And really the main thing is take a friend with you, a relative, spouse, son or daughter, or get in with a society like the ASKC where you can go out and buddy up and share the excitement about it. And also then you're not out there by yourself, because if something does happen, you have somebody there that you can rely on for help.
Sure. So, Rick, how, when you're setting out, do you decide what to look at? How do you decide what you want to capture or view that night?
Well, there's several options. For example, I was out last night because Comet Pan-STARRS is available or viewable in the western horizon just shortly after sunset. It depends also if I'm working on an observing award. The Astronomical League, which the ASKC is a member of, has bunch of different viewing awards for, like, seeing Messier objects, double stars, galaxies, Herschel objects, all sorts of things. Or if I'm just out for pleasure, just random, because sometimes it's just fun to have no plan whatsoever, just to go out and see what you can see. But a lot of times it's just, it's a clear night, it's not 10 below zero, let's go stargazing. I have a program with like a 16 million object database, so I could go out every night for the rest of my life and never see everything.
Sure. You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm Jeremy Bernfeld. Our guests are Rick Henderson and Joe Wright, members of the Astronomical Society of Kansas City. We're discussing the beauty, the mystery, and the science of outer space. So, either of you, do you ever feel that sense of disappointment at not being able to travel to these places that you've been viewing for years at this point?
All the time.
Oh, yes. Astronomy is basically imagination, fantasy. Who hasn't looked up at the sky and wondered what's out there? What's it like to see Saturn or Jupiter from just a few million miles instead of as far away as we are now?
Kansas City, join the conversation. What's the coolest thing you've ever seen in the night sky? Do you have questions for our astronomers here? Call us at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or you can email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. So back in 2001, American investor Dennis Tito paid $20 million to be flown into space. And since then, there have been seven, eight others who've kind of been space tourists. Space tourism sounds like it's kind of coming down the pike. So, I mean, I think I know the answer, but if you could afford it, would you do it? And do you see maybe you or your kids or your grandkids getting out there one day?
Well, my check would probably bounce, but yeah, I'd love to do it. My oldest son probably has a better chance because he's getting his PhD in astronomy at Ohio State University right now. But yeah, I mean, the chance to do something like that would be, pardon the expression, astronomical. And I'm sure Joe would go as well.
Oh, yeah. Who wouldn't? I mean, the astronauts, the Apollo astronauts, and even the astronauts we have now that see Earth from a distance. But when you see it from the distance of the moon, you know, that marble that's floating in space, it'd be a lifetime dream to go out there and do that. Right now, no. None of us have the money in this room, I think, to go on a flight. But, yeah, I would.
Well, it depends on how popular this radio program gets. Maybe one day I'll be out there. We'll see. Landing a man on the moon still stands as one of humankind's greatest and most historic achievements. But, you know, thanks to budget cuts, changing priorities, NASA isn't, you know, doesn't quite have the standing as it once did. So will we eventually get to Mars? Will we keep doing that exploration that seems like it's been so effective in the 20th century?
Well, I really think it depends on the mood of Congress. And these days, who knows? I think we're kind of misdirected, though, because there's so much still yet to be learned from going to the moon. Plus, it's a lot more practical than going to Mars. A lot of people worry about the time it'd take, you know, several years to go to Mars and come back because of the positionings of the planets. But also just the human exposure to things like radiation and some of the dust on Mars is toxic to human life. What a lot of people don't realize about the moon landings is the astronauts had to worry about contamination from the soil on the moon. It was so fine, it was like talcum powder. And after they were there for a few days, the dust was getting into the joints of the spacesuits and basically corroding the suit itself. I mean, you know, messing up the bearings and that sort of things. So the moon is a lot more practical. It's a lot closer, obviously. And they've discovered, you know, significant deposits of water on the moon. So that could be both for human sustenance and also for making fuel like hydrogen.
I think it's inherent in us. If we don't explore, we would never came out of the cage. We wouldn't have seen what's on the other side of the hill, the other side of the ocean. As humans, we have that in us. One of the astronauts that I met from the Apollo program at Linda Hall said if Nixon hadn't cut the program, we'd be on Mars by now. I'm proud to say I'm American, United States of America. And when they launched the Saturn V rocket and it says United States of America on the side, I think we all had a piece of that going to the moon. Nowadays, we don't have that so much. So I really wish NASA would get back into that. So the American people could have their feeling that they're part of the program.
All right. Well, we've gotten some callers here. Let's take a caller. Let's go Jeff from Kansas City. Jeff, you're on Central Standard.
Hi. How's it going?
Great. What's your question?
Well, I had a question and a comment. I kind of got into amateur astronomy just fairly recently. I grew up going down to Bartle Scout Camp as well and just being amazed at being able to look up in the sky and seeing the satellites pass overhead just with the naked eye, which is blown away by that. And for years, I always talked about how I wanted to go to space and wanted to see land or the moon and whatnot. And my girlfriend kind of picked up on that. She bought me a telescope for Christmas. So the day after I got it, we went out, and the first things we saw was Orion's Nebula and the bands on Jupiter. I was just blown away that I could see the bands of Jupiter in my backyard. And I'm curious to ask you guys, once I did this, I kind of started to get the feeling of a slippery slope, so to speak. I can kind of see how I might just be investing a lot of my time and money into this. I'm curious to how much you guys have invested over the years into your quote-unquote amateur hobbies.
Joe, Rick, do you guys want to take that question?
Well, it doesn't have to be a slippery slope. We learn to control ourselves. you don't need a large scope to get into astronomy. One good eye will get you off and running. I started off with a small refractor that we took down to Bartle, and just over the years saved and worked up to larger scopes. One advantage of being a member of the Astronomical Society of Kansas City and any club throughout the country, usually, those clubs have loaner scopes that you can borrow. So you can get used to a scope before you go out and spend some money. But you do want to get a quality scope, you know, starting around $300 or $400 if you're going to stay in it. But we basically, like anything else in life, we save up for it, and most of us stay within our means and buy what we can afford.
Sure. Well, Jeff, thanks so much for calling. And let's go now to Rob from Lenexa.
Hi, gentlemen.
Hi, Rob. What's your question?
Well, I have a question for the ASKC guys. Do you offer programs for young children? And really, what are the best ages to get kids started?
All right, Rick, how do you get them young?
As soon as they start asking questions, it's really not too young ever to be interested in this. I've been stumped by, you know, 5 and 6 year olds because they ask some pretty darn good questions. We do a lot of things with schools. There's a lot of opportunities to have the ASKC come out to a school. We have a lot of kids come out to for different programs at Powell Observatory and also up at Orco. We try to gear our presentations and programs to the audience, and we don't talk down to anyone. We've had people as young as 3 or 4 years old look through the big telescope, and a couple of years ago I had a great-grandmother who was 92 years old, never looked through a telescope before, and we helped her out to look through the 30-inch Powell telescope. So it's really, if they express the interest, I mean, it's a wonderful sky up there. There's lots of things to see and talk about.
And so just to be clear, at the Powell Observatory, which is in Lewisburg, Kansas, it open Saturdays evenings from May to September. Is that right?
The beginning of May to the end of October. And then it's also available year-round by private reservations. Just a couple of months ago, we had a young lady reserve it for her and her boyfriend, and she proposed to him. And then they had a surprise party afterwards. So, I mean, you get all sorts of things out there. But we have a lot of Cub Scout groups, Tiger Scouts, Girl Scouts. We have people of all ages.
I'd like to add something Rick said earlier in addition to the men's comment there. The Astronomical League Awards, they're just not for experienced observers. There are awards for young children, youth do astronomy, Sky Puppy, and other awards. So it's just not a jumping in over your head in the water. There are progressively harder awards you can earn, and they start out as young enough for children, you know, 7, 8 years old.
Rob, thanks for your call. Guys, I don't want to let you out of the studio before getting some kind of more practical advice. Is there anything particularly interesting we can check out tonight or check out this weekend or coming up?
Well, if the weather cooperates, there is a comet Pan-STARRS, which is visible in the western horizon just after sunset. Now, unfortunately, the media tends to hype up comets, and I forget who said it, but comets are like cats. They may or may not have tails, and they're unpredictable. This comet is not particularly bright, but we don't see comets very often. As opposed to this fall, October-November time frame, there's the promise of a very bright comet, Comet Ison. And if predictions hold true, it may actually be the biggest and brightest comet in over 100 years.
I just got handed a comment from Facebook on the KCUR Facebook page. So just head to facebook.com/KCUR if you want to comment. And this is from Rob, and he says that in 1999 he saw an old Russian rocket reentering the atmosphere over Manhattan. Several cars pulled over to watch it burn across the sky. Is that just one of those serendipitous experiences?
There's a lot of stuff floating around Earth that's left up there. Mankind is very good at leaving things behind. Rocket boosters, other parts of spacecraft that are, their orbits decay. I think that might have been one of the ones that we saw from Powell Observatory that put on quite a show that night. So there's always stuff floating through space, just meteors, asteroids. I mean, look at what last month we had the flyby of the asteroid on the same day that we happened to have a errant meteor crash into Russia. So think about playing pool, but make it 3D, and that's what being in the solar system is like.
Oh, that's real comforting. That's a comforting image. Kansas City, again, we want you to join the conversation. We want you to call in. What's the coolest thing you've ever seen in the night sky? Or do you have other questions for our astronomers? You can call us at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or you can log on to Facebook or find us on Twitter at KCRCST. Email us at centralstandard@kcr.org. So we've got Bob on the line, Bob from Fairway. Hi, Bob. Bob, are you there? We may have lost Bob. That's okay. I've got a question instead from this is from someone on Twitter. How can we view the International Space Station? And for someone who's unpracticed like me, how can we tell that it's a space station?
Well, there's a couple of websites. I believe it's, what is it, Heavens Above?
Yes, yeah. heavensabove.com.
Heavensabove.com. You can log on to that, and it will tell you the predicted times when the space station will fly overhead. It'll tell you where to look, what time in the evening to look, and about how long you can see it. The space station, because what you're primarily seeing is the solar panel reflections, which are reflecting off the sun, it's pretty interesting because it will just kind of appear out of nowhere, get brighter and brighter and brighter, reach a peak brightness, and then dim as the angles change in relation to the sun and the Earth's shadow. And it's pretty amazing. It's if you know where to look, it happens fairly frequently, and it's not that hard to see. And it's a fun thing to see that, you know, that's us up there.
And that same website will list other satellites that are going overhead that you can see for your location, and including Iridium flares, which are similar to the space station, where they'll be coming out of Earth's shadow, and if you're in the right spot, they'll be brighter than anything in the sky other than the moon. And that website will allow you to save different web locations. So if you have vacation spots or different places that you're at frequently, you can almost like bookmark them so you don't have to put in their coordinates. And you can look this up, and it'll give you a 24-hour prediction and a 7-day prediction.
So I've read that members of your group have discovered and tracked asteroids. Can you talk a little bit about the kind of more serious astronomy and scientific discovery that goes on at Powell and with members of your group?
Well, we call those the people with no social life. we had a group of people that operating the Ruysinger, that's our 30-inch telescope, that would work with the Harvard Minor Planet Center to do asteroid trajectory confirmation. A lot of times people will discover, one of the robotic observatories will discover an object, but to know where it's going, you have to track it over several days, sometimes several weeks and months. And also, because of the position on the Earth, you want a network of observatories around the globe to be able to say, at this time of night, can you find this object and give us coordinate readings, times, and all that reporting. And we've done that. There was a key group of about a half a dozen individuals that literally spent hundreds of hours working at Powell doing this. And in the process, they actually discovered, I believe it was two asteroids?
Maybe three. It's been a while. I don't remember.
And one of them we actually named after the city of Lewisburg. And it does take a serious amount of dedication, and you do need special equipment. Although the equipment available to amateurs today is pretty much comparable to what NASA had 20 or 30 years ago. So it's amazing what amateurs are doing these days.
And it was part of a NASA grant that we applied for and received to purchase some of the equipment to do that back around 1999, and we've done it for almost 5 years, where we were ranked, I think, third in the world for doing asteroid imaging and follow-ups.
And Joe, you were part of that team that was working on that?
There was myself, Richard Frederick,
Dick Trentman.
Dick Trentman, David Young, Larry O'Urino.
But what's that like? Doing real scientific research on an asteroid. I mean, you know, we've all seen the movies, but you were really working on it.
Yeah, you go to the Minor Planet Center's website, download a hot list. Sometimes it's not necessarily important to discover a new one. It's the establish the orbits of the ones that they're not sure where they're at or have lost. And, you know, from a collision or something, maybe their orbit has changed. And you'd do some imaging. You'd start out in a group, and Kyle, Smiley, or somebody would go down there, open up the 12 or the 30, and start imaging. And basically, you'd start out with a list about 5 or 10 comets. About every 5 minutes, you'd be taking a picture. Then once you started getting a series of them, you can actually do, like in the old days, of what we call blinking, flashing them on the screen, and you'd line the stars on the screen, and if anything moved, it could be an asteroid.
So if I want to impress my friends, how can I identify what I'm seeing? I mean, I know kind of the dippers, but what else? What else is notable that I can kind of take a quick look at?
Well, the constellations are always a good thing to start with, and knowing your constellations is also a good reference point for finding your way around the night sky. You should probably consult either like some planetarium software or magazines to know where the planets are, because they change throughout the season. And then also, you know, you never know when a comet's going to pop up. So a lot of it's just being informed, checking out websites, magazines, current information. But there's always something to see.
We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we explore reality itself and the big puzzles within our minds. Central Standard returns in just a moment.